Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. A reminder that we Zoomed the day before, so if something should happen on Wednesday night, we will not be discussing it on our Thursday show. Yes, you know the drill. We begin every show, and we have since probably March, with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. I told you before, and I will tell you again, I want his testimony, his courage, speaking truth to power to be ringing in your ears when you exercise the franchise, be it absentee ballot, mail-in voting, or actually showing up in person during the election of November of 2020. Now the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. Talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
So I read this site called Naked Capitalism.
Yes. And
Naked Capitalism is a great
name.
So I read Naked Capitalism and I'm always mining it, Mark, for for like great content and great stories. And so I go to Naked Capitalism and I religiously do it every single morning. And I see an article at the Akron Beacon Journal. Now, I don't really check out the Akron Beacon Journal. I'll have to admit it. But I read the headline and I went, I don't care what this is. And it turns out it was actually reproduced in other journals as well. Mark Dunn is the former Ohio Attorney General. He wrote a piece entitled, Want to Stop Public Corruption, Jail Business Execs Who Break the Law. I think we were separated at birth, Mark. I have been saying that over and over and over again. And my greatest regret from the 2008 economic meltdown was that nobody did a perp walk. And because of that, I really do think that they have sort of were having a wink and a nod that they had a license to continue to do some of the bad behavior, because in the end, what's a fine when you're making billions of dollars? It's merely the cost of doing business. I want to welcome you to the program and thank you so much for writing this. Because as we move into the 2020 campaign and we look at possible changes in administration, I hope they read your piece. And I hope as they look at sort of dealing with Wall Street and major tech companies and corporations, that we begin to understand that it isn't just about enforcing regulations. It's about understanding that when there is criminal activity, that there are consequences. So thank you so much for joining us.
No, and thank you. And I kind of feel, having read a little bit about you and your background, that we were separated at birth, and I would have been less lonely as a member of the legislature, as I imagine you would have been had we had a chance to work together. So I regret that.
So, you know, so I want to go back a little bit in history to understand for people that what happened in 2008 was in part a real aberration, that nobody did a perp walk. And that if you really want to, again, you want to deal with public corruption, you have to deal with this, because this really is the underpinnings of that. And I went back to a PBS special. And the PBS special was entitled, it was from 2013, Were Bankers Jailed in Past Financial Crises? And what was so interesting, and I had gone back to the savings and loan and I knew that story, but they went back to the Great Depression and the other big sort of financial crisis. And it turned out that bankers didn't go to jail around the Great Depression. That was not actually employed as a tool. But when Ronald Reagan, oh my God, when I think about it, when Ronald Reagan was president and there was the savings and loan debacle, It turned out that 1,000 bankers went to jail. Mark, the story that I remember is the Keating Five. And the reason why I remember the Keating Five wasn't just about who went to jail as a result of that, but it had consequences for one of my old friends, Senator John McCain, because it actually came back to haunt McCain as well, because he supported and received money from the Keating Five. So I want people to know that one of the reasons why you want to deal with this kind of corruption is that it actually cleans up the acts of people who are passively running for president going into the future. So let's talk about your piece and why you are intimate with this story, because as an attorney general in Ohio, you understood what the consequences would mean for your state.
It really started when I was in the legislature and bankers would come in. We had a bill. There was a bill. There was a great predatory lending law in Cleveland, one of the best in the country. And there was a bill to create a state law that would preempt it, which is legislator code for neuter it and make it ineffective. And I was so excited because the bank lobbyists would come in to meet me. And I was never on the same side with the bank lobbyists for National City. And Ohio is actually a pretty big banking capital. I think we were second or third after New York for the number of bank headquarters at the time. Mm-hmm. So folks from National City and Fifth Third and Key Bank all came into my office. And I said, this is great. We're going to be on the same side of this issue because, you know, I want to drive all these home borrowers to your brick and mortar bank so that they will get a conventional loan at a fair rate, that you will properly underwrite them, that they know they can have the traditional relationship that people have had. Because look, you know, when I went to borrow money for the first time when I was a young lawyer, my worry was not that I would borrow too much, but that the bank wouldn't think I had enough money coming in to make sure I could make my payments. And so that was the relationship that Americans expected that they had with banks. And then they looked at me and said, oh, no, we're for the preemption bill. And what it turned out later, and they never admitted to me, was they all had subsidiaries who were originating these predatory loans.
I know what a predatory loan is, in part because, just to give you a little sidebar as we're having this conversation, we have a business school called the Peter T. Paul School of Business and Economics. Peter T. Paul, do you know what he's known as? The father of liar loans. He named our business school after the father of liar loans. So remind everyone of what is a predatory lending and why were you opposed to it and these banks were for it? Because I think people need to understand, we use these terms of art as if people have this memory, but they really don't. And yet what you were describing about when you were originally borrowing money, you were afraid that your banker would say no because you didn't have enough income coming in. And then what happened was bankers forgot to look at income because they didn't care about whether they wrote you a loan or not. And that really is what is so unfortunate and what drove the 2008 economic meltdown.
Well, that and the fact that they hired corrupt appraisers who would value homes. And the reason that that happened is because there was a change in the law in 1999, again, lobbied by Wall Street, that allowed mortgages to be pooled together into securities and then sold on the bond market, backing bonds that became increasingly more complex and increasingly less understandable to the bond buyers at the end of the day. To fund these bonds was so great that the biggest Wall Street firms, all of them, Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers, who the only one that got their just desserts in all this, all of the big investors, Merrill Lynch and all the way down the line, they were giving huge lines of credit and made them available to lenders, mortgage brokers, who became increasingly less professional and had no interest at all in whether or not those loans would succeed, whether the payments would be made. So it would make sense. Why would somebody loan somebody more money than they should on a house that's not worth as much as they say it is based on income that they can't prove? That's because the originators of the loan took a huge fee and then sold that hot potato loan off to an investment bank, and the investment bank then went through a couple of gyrations to protect itself and then put it into bond offerings and divided those up bond offerings into tranches that were all, you know, one was more risky than the next, and nobody could put a value on those loans. Nobody at the investment bank took a look at the values or the incomes. Nobody at the bond rating agencies took a look at the values or the incomes. Why? Because they were all operating in their own financial self-interest. And because of the deregulation of banking and Wall Street and mortgages prior to 2008, nobody was looking at them. There was no government oversight whatsoever.
You know, as I'm listening to you, I want to scream because, again, I always teach my children that actions have consequences. What we have learned from what you just described is these actions had no consequences, which is why they became riskier and riskier and riskier, because if you don't care whether someone pays you back, you don't care whether you loan them $1 million or $5. And if you can make more money on the $1 million that you loan them, you're going to loan them $1 million, whether they can pay you back or not, because they don't have to pay you back, because you've dumped that borrowing onto somebody else's plate. And then what you keep describing is it got denser and more crazy, and you actually had difficulty following the loan because it right. got sort of dissolved into these packages, which is just amazing. One of the things I wish people were able to say today is, you know how Donald Trump runs around and celebrates all the deregulation that he is responsible for. This story that you talk about, if these people had only done a perp walk, maybe they would have learned something. One of the reasons why they didn't do a perp walk is that what used to be illegal, when we deregulated, that illegal activity suddenly became kind of more loosey-goosey and almost legal. So in a lot of ways, it made it harder for us to throw the book at them, because if we had these regulations with teeth on the books, it would be clear that what they were doing was not only violating a regulation, but criminal, both in its intent and its effect. And I think that's part of the consequences of deregulation, is that you're right, throw the book at them, but when the book has lots of holes in it, it's harder to do it.
But Arnie, I think you're letting the Obama administration off the hook here too much. And look, I'm a Democrat, okay? Believe me, it pains me to say this, especially now, because, you know, nobody, you probably more than me, want to see Trump not reelected, but I certainly am passionate about that and believe for my clients and my family and my country, that's a critical thing to happen. The fact is, fraud is fraud is fraud. When people are committing fraud and misrepresenting things to unsuspecting, generally middle-class, working-class, African-American, you know, to a large extent, homeowners, promising them that their house is worth, look, they were literally in Cleveland neighborhoods and in Akron neighborhoods, and this is in the five-part series, The Con, that I worked on with a guy named Bill Black, who I want to talk about with you as well, who was the guy that ran the savings and loan crisis for the regulator that sent 30,000 criminal referrals to the Justice Department that resulted in those 1,000 convictions. The fact is that they were going door to door saying, hey, did you know your house was worth your $20,000 house was worth $100,000? And guess what? I'll loan you this. I'm going to bring your mortgage payment down because I'm going to give you an interest-only loan. Don't worry, because in 10 years or 5 years or 3 years, that loan's going to kick into an amortizing loan and the payment's going to go up. But you just call me back and I'll refinance that loan. And off it goes. There were 2, 3, 4 generations. And in fact, the con focuses on a woman in Akron, Addie Polk, who committed suicide when the sheriffs came to take her house. She just had no idea what had happened and how she got there.
Let me stop you for one quick second, because I come from a very strange family. My brother is a Wall Street banker. Mm-hmm. My brother is exactly sort of the guy that you are describing in The Con in a lot of ways. Not that he's corrupt per se, but he knew how to make a lot of money for tapes, okay?
Yes.
He knew how to make a lot of money. He started at Manny Hanny and then went through the rest. So my brother used to talk about the fact that it wasn't that bankers were abusing their privilege, it's that people who were buying these houses knew that they couldn't afford these houses, that they knew that they didn't have the income coming in. And in a way, it was their con, not the banker's con. So let me just remind my audience. I said to my brother one day when we were having this huge fight at the dining room table, that bankers were in the business of lending money. That meant that they would lend, maybe they would talk to 5 clients a day, maybe 50 clients a week. I said, when I bought a house, it's the only time. I am not sophisticated. I don't know what the frick I'm doing. I don't know how to read the papers. This is a case of first impression. My level of sophistication is Zippo. I said, and your level of sophistication is at the top of Mount Olympus. I said, so if anyone had a fiduciary responsibility to act wisely and correctly and protect me, it was you. And that's part of the problem, is it was such an unlevel playing field that this woman that committed suicide, of course she didn't know. No one ever taught her what to know. Bankers knew that. That was part of the reason why they were so successful at being able to sell these garbage products.
Right. Part of what is in The Con and I don't mean to, I'm shamelessly promoting a TV series that I happen to appear in, but I have no interest in at all. I just want you to know.
Okay, I'm watching but I'm going to watch it.
You should watch it, though. It really is something, I think. And it puts this story together end to end. And it took a long time. I mean, 5 episodes is a lot of putting together, but they did. In Ohio, we had a similar scheme going on that was very localized. So in the city of Akron and in Summit County and in Stark County, Ohio, there was a company called Carnation Bank and mortgage brokers that were affiliated with it that were doing exactly the same thing, going door to door, originating loans, and then pooling those loans and selling them in bonds directly. They skipped Wall Street, but they did it themselves. When I was Attorney General, we convened a task force under the Organized Crime Task Force. So we used the tools that we had available to us, where I was able to fund experts and accountants and those kinds of things. We convened a task force of local law enforcement. We borrowed people from the county auditor's office and from who understood money, because you get a bunch of really, really wonderful cops together, and you'll see from the show. But they're used to chasing down drug dealers and bank robbers, and they're not used to dealing with this kind of complicated crime. So we brought the experts in. We hired a forensic accountant to help them, and I kind of gave them an open budget to do that. And at the end of the day, they brought RICO charges against all the people involved, and 5 or 6 of them went to prison. Believe me, there's no local banker in Akron that's going to try to do that again. Now, nobody, just like you said, nobody reads the Akron Beacon Journal, you know, other than people in Akron and Cleveland. And so if Eric Holder and the U.S. Justice Department, which were the only entities that had the resources to prosecute these crimes, and the FBI had put their resources into this, then very likely we would not have been facing some of the future crises that came. Because what was next? It was the opioid crisis. Now we have a murder scheme murdering millions of working class Americans. I represent the children of people who were addicted when they were pregnant, who were born and now suffer consequences for their lifetime of the crime of the opioid industry and in creating an environment where somehow there was a difference between addiction and dependence on drugs, and that selling the same material that's in heroin for long-term pain management and convincing otherwise smart doctors to do that, nobody from that scheme has gone to jail. And the Sacklers have filed for, Purdue's filed for bankruptcy. And the Sacklers, now we're fighting over whether they're going to have to put 1 or 2 more billion of their $6 billion that they still have into the bankruptcy estate to not compensate enough the people that are involved. This one goes on to the new administration. No prosecution at all.
So, Marcus, I'm listening to you. I've been thinking about Black Lives Matter. And I was listening to someone, maybe it was on MSNBC or CNN, and talking about there's two kinds of justice. There's the justice for white people, and there's the justice for black people. And they're obviously talking about what's happening with some of the police situations. I want people to take this story also of another form of justice. So you rob a 7-Eleven of $50, you go to jail. You rob the nation of millions and billions of dollars, you pay a fine. For example, during the 2008 economic meltdown, Credit Suisse had a settlement of $5.3 billion. Goldman Sachs had a settlement of $5.1 billion. Can I just tell you something? That's pocket change.
Well, it sounds like a big number, Arnie, but it's a rounding error for these guys. I mean, that's what it is.
Exactly. So they factor in these things into the cost of doing business. So unless you do exactly what your article says, unless there is real consequences, i.e. jail, for the people that are at the top of the food chain, guess what? There is actually no incentive for them to behave differently.
Right. That's right. And the conduct, whether it's in opioids next or in whatever the next scheme that somebody comes up with, is going to be protected. Because Comey brought together, when he became the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, one of the most prestigious prosecutor's offices in the country, he brought all the prosecutors together and asked how many people to raise their hand, how many people who had lost a case. He asked to raise their hand. Almost nobody raised their hand. And he goes, well, the rest of you are the chicken you-know-what clubs, because you're not bringing cases that are difficult. Prosecutors need to bring cases that are challenging. And so the problem is the career path of a Justice Department official or a deputy U.S. attorney is to go then from the U.S. attorney's office into a white shoe law firm where something that didn't exist 20 years ago when I started practicing law, 35 years ago when I started practicing law, they have criminal departments at the biggest law firms in the country. That's where Eric Holder and Lanny Davis came from and went back to after they left the Obama administration. They went back to a big white shoe Wall Street law firm, and they were defending criminals. And at the end of the day, if you're being too harsh on the clients of those big law firms, you're not going to get that $1 million a year partnership when you leave that public job. I mean, it's interesting. I don't know if you recall when Trump was trying to replace the U.S. attorney in the northern in the Southern District of New York just a few months ago. As with everything in the Trump administration, they said the secret part out loud. Look, if you go to the SEC and become the SEC director, you'll get a much better job when you get out of government.
I mean, again, people don't understand the financial value of the revolving door. The revolving door isn't just about what you think is sort of corruption because you're sort of buying the regulators, but in a way, it's kind of like a pre-buy. So you leave the white shoe firm to go into government, and then they pay you a bonus as you leave because they know you're not going to get paid much in government. And then you leave government and you go back to the white shoe firm. But while you're working for government, guess what? You aren't losing cases because you aren't doing the tough cases because you want to go back to that white shoe firm. I need to let you go, but one of the things I did, I had to speak at St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota, right after the 2008 economic meltdown. And they did this sort of big, almost Minnesota-wide conversation about what happened and how to explain it. So I went and said, sure, I'll moderate the day for you. And then I realized that there was nobody that would explain what you and Black would have talked about and explain the two. Everybody was on one side, but not on the other side. So it was all the people that would explain away the problem, all the bankers that would explain away the problem, all the regulators that didn't do their regulation. And I said, I won't come. This is literally what happened. When I looked at the list of people there, I said, it is one-sided. I will not come. And they said, well, Arnie, you're the moderator. You can be the other side. I said, excuse me? You want me to be the other side? As if I have the knowledge and the institutional memory to do this? So here was the let's make a deal, and you will love this, Mark Dunn. I said, I will not show up on campus unless you show a documentary to the entire campus before I come. What was the documentary? Inside Job. And if you haven't seen this, everyone, I'm going to recommend that as you vote in 2020, you watch The Con, you watch Inside Job, you begin to understand why when they run around those Republicans and they talk about deregulation, when you see the consequences of deregulation, whether it's the opioid crisis, whether it's what's happening with your mortgage in your home, whether it's happening with the air you breathe, this is what deregulation gets you. It doesn't get you safety. It doesn't get you security. It actually makes you vulnerable. And I think, Mark, that's why I loved your article. We can't forget this now. In some ways, this needs to be front and center because when you look at the years of Donald Trump, it really was everything we hated from sort of the beginning of the deregulation with Bill Clinton, even through the Obama administration, but put that on steroids because look what he's done. He's raised criminal activity to such a point that it makes your head spin. And the fact that he still might win is what's so terrifying.
It is. And he somehow manages to push the blame off on everybody else. And I believe in my heart that Joe Biden's a good-hearted person and wants to do the right thing at the end of the day. Not just voting, but leading this discussion in your community and leading it with your congressman and your senator about this. You know, it shocked me because you and I were in politics before, you know, big online fundraising existed. I thought that would liberate politicians from the influence of money in politics. And in fact, it has just had the opposite effect. Exactly. And it's really tragic. I mean, there were moments in time where I thought this would change everything. And yet, my mom used to say, you can't be too rich or too thin. You know, there's never enough money, apparently, for some of these folks, or the golden parachute or the revolving door on the other side. And until that ends, it's not going to We're not going to improve the quality of lives for working class people.
I don't want to let you go. You are my twin. You are my twin, Mark Dunn. You are my twin. Mark Dunn wrote a piece at the Akron Beacon Journal. It's been reproduced in a number of other publications. It was entitled, Want to Stop Public Corruption? Jail Business Execs Who Break the Law. And Mark, you are absolutely right. We have to keep the heat on. I have said this over and over, and Stephanie and Dave will tell you this. They've heard it from me. And that is, I believe that Joe Biden leads from behind. And what does that mean? That means Mark Dunn and Arnie Arneson, we got to be in front. That's all I have to say. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you so much for writing. And I have to thank Naked Capitalism for posting your piece, because that's how I found you. So stay safe and stay well. Ciao.
Thanks,
take care. All right. This is the Thursday edition of The Attitude. We'll be right back.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 2012. That was the day the Chicago Teachers Union walked off the job for the first time in 25 years. The historic week-long strike resonated nationwide among trade unionists and served to reinvigorate the labor movement. Certainly, higher wages and better benefits were among the teachers' demands. The city's mayor, Rahm Emanuel, had canceled the union's wage increase, laid off close to 1,000 teachers, and went on the attack against seniority rights and working conditions. The strike enjoyed wide public support among parents and the public. Teachers emphasized broader educational problems they faced, namely the attacks fueled by corporate privatization. They wanted a return to more traditional forms of education, rather than simply preparing students for endless rounds of testing. They wanted more art, music, and gym classes. And they demanded stable funding for social support services for the most vulnerable at-risk students. Union teachers understood that the Board of Education was using standardized testing to get rid of teachers and schools in order to privatize education, all in the name of turning around failing schools and helping the kids. Though the contract was less than perfect, it showed the power working people have to hold the line against continued assaults on their standards of living, especially in the public sector. The CTU was able to beat back attempts at merit pay and increased use of student test scores in teacher evaluations. They won first-time recall rights, supply reimbursements, and liberal arts classes. There were concessions, however, made on seniority rights, pay for laid-off teachers, and longer workdays. But the CTU demonstrated that strikes can win in a period of extended anti-union onslaughts.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Oh, yes, wait a minute, Mr. Bozeman.
Welcome to part two of the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We go to Slate.com a lot. One of my absolute favorite people, no offense to Jeremy, is Mark Joseph Stern, who we completely adore. His last comment on Twitter about Bill Barr was like something I replicated on Facebook, and I'm like, absolutely. And then I go to Slate, and I'm in the news and politics section, And I see, oh, Jeremy has written a piece. Jeremy Stahl is a senior editor at Slate.com, and we've had him on a number of times. And he, too, is just a fabulous interview. But Jeremy, this piece about Louis DeJoy, holy moly, it is so freaking comprehensive. I cannot tell you. I want you to please, please, I beg you, Jeremy, the title of his piece is This Is Still Happening, Louis DeJoy, Postmaster General, a roundup of Trump administration malfeasance. Is this part 11 or pile 2? But the story of DeJoy, you go into such background and history of him. And I think it's really important that we put the postmaster into a piece that doesn't begin with his appointment by that five-member board or whatever it is, but that really sort of does a bit of a backstory of his history. Because when you see his history, you want to take a shower. And then after you realize he's now the postmaster and we're talking about voting by mail, your anger cannot be controlled. Welcome to the program, Jeremy, and thank you for this incredibly well-researched and detailed piece, because I think when you see the man as a whole, you understand why he defines almost corruption. So welcome to the program.
Thank you, Artie. And it was part 11 of the malfeasance updates, just because we've had so much material to work with and we could do a dozen more parts before the election, I'm sure, very easily. The ways in which the Postmaster General has, you know, risen to this job, it's one of the most extreme examples of this administration, of this sort of pay-to-play and really, frankly, just blatant and open corruption that it has put out into the world. And I appreciate everything you just said about the piece. Thank you very much.
Everyone knows a little bit. They know that he's postmaster. They know that what's happening with the USPS. They know that now he's basically been caught by sort of maybe laundering his donations by, you know, forcing his employees to pay. But your piece is more important in a lot of ways, because I want people to understand that this guy has a pattern in practice. This is so obvious. The fact is, everybody had to be sort of rubbing somebody else's back and sort of winking and nodding as they moved him up through the food chain. Take us from a little bit of the beginning of like who he is, where he began, sort of his behavior when he was in North Carolina that ultimately led to him being a major contributor to Donald Trump, and now in this position of incredible power as the Postmaster General.
He founded this company, Breed Logistics, you know, more than 20 years ago, and it became a major player in terms of doing logistics for the Postal Service. This is obviously long before he was ever even considered to be Postmaster General. It was around this time he moved the company to North Carolina, and he started to become a major bundler and contributor and fundraiser for the Republican Party, he and his wife, who is currently up for the ambassadorship to Canada. During this time that, allegedly, according to this new reporting in the Washington Post, the former human resources director for Breed Logistics said that while he was, you know, inviting all of these top executives and staff and middle managers to donate to these Republican causes, he was ultimately, allegedly, compensating them back in the form of bonuses that would pay for the contributions, that would pay for the taxes that came along with the contributions, in order to get around campaign finance laws that said you can only donate this much to a candidate. This went on for, according to the human resources director for Breed Logistics and a number of other employees, one of which I believe was named on the record. This is the most egregious example that we've seen so far of this kind of pay-to-play corruption that he's been accused of. But the interesting and funny thing is that he was actually asked about this during his House Oversight Committee congressional appearance the other week. And it was a very out of left field question. And it struck me at the time as something that was, it was asked in this kind of timid, awkward way by Representative Jim Cooper, but it seemed also to be very come out of nowhere. And he responded extremely indignantly, questioned what he was being asked, accused of, and basically offered he had done nothing of the sort. And he was, to be fair, he was asked about a very specific period of time that we don't know he was doing this. What he's accused of is an illegal straw donor money laundering scheme. He's currently in charge of the post office.
Unfortunately, I have a relationship with North Carolina that will shock some people. And my relationship with North Carolina is I knew a guy that formerly ran for governor in North Carolina as a conservative Christian, who then ran for Congress and became a congressman, who then left Congress and became the chair of the Republican Party in North Carolina. eventually retired, and then got returned as the chair of the Republican Party in North Carolina. And when it comes to the Republican Party in North Carolina, corruption is them. And as I realized that DeJoy was from North Carolina, every bell and whistle went off. And the question that was asked, unfortunately, is not surprising. And I have an article in front of me. The article is from August 19, 2020. North Carolina political donor gets 7 years in prison. The former chairman of the Republican Party in North Carolina gets probation. Okay? This is what I am looking at as I am reading your story about Postmaster General DeJoy. He comes from a place where it's almost presumed that this kind of behavior happens within the Republican Party in North Carolina. That is how outrageous it is. So in a lot of ways, there's so much money washing around. So many Republicans act this way. The problem with him is that not only did he do this and use this money within a North Carolina sort of template, but he was then able to sort of realize that if this works at the North Carolina level, imagine what I can do nationally. And that's where you begin to see where he starts writing huge checks for Donald Trump. I just tweeted this out the other day. The only thing Donald Trump really honors, he doesn't honor the military. He really doesn't honor the police. He honors checks with two commas in them. That's what he honors. Not one comma, but two commas. And what we know about DeJoy is he was able to be a huge contributor, not just to Donald Trump, but to the National Republican Party and to a lot of key players that were going to be running for Congress on the Republican side of the aisle. As a consequence of this, this is what he gets. So let's talk about his behavior as Postmaster General and also remind people how he became Postmaster General. He did not have to get approved by Congress. I never understood the whole story of the Postmaster General, but by sort of reading your piece, it reinforced for me the little bits and pieces I remembered about how he even got there, because how he even became Postmaster General was really almost a form of corruption.
It's important to describe that process by which he became, in the interview specifically, how he was elevated, but it's also important, as you just described, to note the amounts of money that he was pouring into the Republican Party at this time of the Trump era as a Trump donor and as a Republican donor for during this period. And, you know, this alleged straw donor campaign scheme is said to have occurred between 2000-2014. This was before the Citizens United Supreme Court ruling made it so that you could give unlimited amounts of money, essentially, to bolster political campaigns through super PACs. He has taken that opportunity in these most recent years to become a multi-million dollar donor to the GOP. And he gave more than $1 million to the Trump campaign, and he gave more than $1 million to the RNC in this period. And then he became one of the leading members of the Republican Finance Committee at this time, right after Trump was elected, along with Michael Cohen, who is now in jail, and Elliot Broidy, who has been charged with crimes related to his own work there. And these are the senior people at this Republican Finance Committee. And it just shows what was going on there at the time. And Louis DeJoy was one of these people. That is important context to have in the background when we talk about how he was elevated. He was elevated because Steven Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, had conversations with the chairman of the Board of Governors that makes this decision, saying what he was looking for in a Postmaster General. And this is a very unusual thing to do. This is not standard practice. Usually this appointment is done free of political interference. And so instead of taking from this list of 200 people that a consulting firm produced for the Board of Governors of people from whom to select the next Postmaster General, Duncan elevated specifically DeJoy. He had a couple of interviews, and they didn't, according to the reporting of the people who were talking about it, they didn't go particularly well. He didn't really know what he was talking about. And some of the board members had to answer questions for him and joke about how it was, you know, basically his job if he wanted it. Then, you know, in May, he got the job.
Let me just stop you here, because I really want to highlight what you just said, because this paragraph, I have it all highlighted on my piece of paper. You write, DeJoy was named as Postmaster General in May, which is just how you ended this last conversation. There were many unusual things about the appointment. Let's go back again. For one, he's the first Postmaster General in 20 years not to have worked for the Postal Service. So the fact that, Jeremy, he couldn't answer any of those questions, duh. You know, he didn't know anything. He probably never looked a stamp in his life. Second, the main reason DeJoy got the job seems to be that he'd been a longtime Republican mega donor. Again, what you point out is that's what that was his gig. His gig was writing big checks to Republicans, and he was due to be the national finance chairman for the last months of the Republican National Convention. But this is my absolute favorite. Third, DeJoy was not on the list of 212 candidates elevated by the consulting firm that was in charge of recruitment for the position. Indeed, he was recommended by the Trump-appointed chairman of the USPS Board of Governors, Robert Duncan, another longtime Republican mega donor and a former chairman of the Republican National Committee. I mean, this is so incestuous. It is just incredible. I mean, the fact that he even had to do an interview is a joke, Jeremy, because this was preordained. It had nothing to do with his skill set. It had nothing to do with his resume. It had everything to do with his cash and that he would be a yes man for whatever the administration wanted him to do with the post office. Am I correct here? I mean, it is so obvious from this paragraph that that's exactly why he was placed there.
The level of blatantness, the level of openness, and the level of compromise that to put somebody like that in that position, even if there was no awareness of what he was alleged to have done earlier in the 2000s in North Carolina with that straw donor scheme, even without that knowledge, just there's a chutzpah and a certain like complete boldness and shamelessness to put somebody like that in that position. It's par for the course, really. If you talk about shamelessness, you can just look yesterday at the Attorney General having his Department of Justice offer the Department of Justice to defend a personal accusation of defamation by E. Jean Carroll, who has accused the president of rape, and the Department of Justice stepping in and saying, oh, he was in his official capacity when he basically said, she's not my type. And he was acting in his official capacity as president. So now the people of the United States of America are on the hook to defend him. All of these pieces come together to just demonstrate a shamelessness, but also we don't really care if you see how open we are about this.
So, you know, I just interviewed the former AG from Ohio, and we were talking about the fact that nobody did a perp walk after the 2008 economic meltdown. And I told him that, you know, one of my absolute favorite documentaries on the planet is Inside Job. And I'm thinking that I almost want to go back to the same guy that produced that, you know, award-winning Inside Job and ask him to do another documentary that's entitled Inside the Envelope, the story of Postmaster General DeJoy, because he's got it all. He's got everything that we, in a way that we saw from Inside Job about the economic meltdown that got people so angry when they saw the blatant abuse and just sort of the back scratching and all this kind of stuff. In a way, the DeJoy story is even more outrageous. But before I let you go, let's get to his behavior once he becomes the postmaster. Because in a way, you know, getting there was a problem. Getting there was wrong. Getting there has so many reasons why he should never have even been interviewed for this job. But the fact of the matter was, it was a slam dunk, and there was a slam dunk with a reason. So let's remind everyone what DeJoy did in the excuse of making the post office more quote-unquote efficient.
So we don't know and this is going to be for the oversight investigators to try to continue to get at, but we don't know the actual motives and the reasons for what they're trying to do here. Obviously, President Trump suggested that he wanted to sabotage the mail because he didn't want people to have mail-in voting options. He said this, he stated this, but he's also attacked Amazon.com and the Postal Service relationship with Amazon.com and said that he doesn't like their shipping rates, and Amazon.com is obviously owned by Jeff Bezos, who owns the Washington Post, who Trump has attacked for the way that they cover him. So the reasons for why this has happened, and then the U.S. Postal Service employees wonder if this is part of a privatization attempt, because they feared privatization for a very, very, very long time. So the reasons for why this is happening are kind of hard to pin down at this point, you know, any specific official reason. But the results are clear, and the results are just obvious. And the results are that once DeJoy came into this position, he started implementing a number of changes, the most prominent of which was that they would change the hours and schedules of trucks leaving, and that trucks would no longer be allowed to go out on secondary runs, which were pretty common, as a cost-cutting measure. Through that, hours would be cut significantly, overtime hours would be cut significantly, and just the number of people doing work to get the mail to people, that the amount of time they were spent doing it, would be reduced significantly. And lo and behold, what happens July 10th when that memo is issued? What happens the very next day, July 11th, the day after this change is implemented and instituted and sent out to the U.S. Postal Service? Service crashes. Service crashes in specific regions and specific sectors of the country, but basically across the board, service crashes. It crashes by 10%. It goes, the on-time delivery rates go down by 10% immediately after this is done. After the uproar around this, he was confronted with a lot of these things, and he said, "I'm suspending some of these changes. I'm putting them on hold." Service recovered a little bit at the end of August after this supposed suspension, but it's still down 5% as of the end of August, which is when we have the last numbers for.
Let me just give you some numbers, though. One of the things that you mentioned here is that there was a plan predated by DeJoy's arrival that began to take out of operation 671 mail sorting machines. And you said that's more than double the amount decommissioned in the past 2 years combined. The timing is incredibly interesting. My understanding is they also took out some key mailboxes where people post their mail. So where they used to be, and the location of where those mailboxes were taken out, I think there is a blue state connection or an urban relationship connection. So that's kind of interesting as well. I mean, we know USPS has been struggling. And Jeremy, we did a really interesting interview a couple of months ago with a guy from ProPublica. And this was before the installation of DeJoy. And this was a story about the challenges for the post office before it, okay? So we already knew that they were facing real financial problems. Then, of course, let's not forget, Jeremy, they've suffered the consequences of COVID-19 as well. So their people have been harmed from this pandemic. So they are working on a sort of a thinner shoestring, and they have fewer people because COVID has taken out some of their personnel. And then you put in the sort of the slime multiplier named, you know, Postmaster General DeJoy, and the situation is really problematic. And I guess that's where my concern is. But I do have a question, and I don't know whether you were able to ask this as you were exploring the whole issue of the postmaster. And someone said to me, "Oh, Arnie, what are you worried about with this absentee balloting and the mail-in voting? Look what happens at Christmas. They manage perfectly fine at Christmas when they get dumped with all these Christmas cards and New Year's cards and Hanukkah cards. If they can handle Christmas, they can handle this." Now, I'm just kind of curious, how do you respond to that, Jeremy?
So I would say that compared to Christmas and compared to the normal mail load, that person would be correct in saying that mail-in balloting, even if everybody in the country did mail-in balloting, would be, you know, a fraction of a normal week's load of mail or a normal month's load of mail. The issue is that it might not take that many ballots being returned late and or not counted at all or not sent out to the people at all to even receive them and send them back at all, by a week, by a few days, by however long, for it to have an enormous impact on this next election. And the problem is that what you have from this Postmaster General, his general counsel sending letters to individual states saying, "We might have problems with your deadlines. We might not be able to get back these ballots in time." You have him, even after his congressional appearance where he said, "We're going to do everything we can to make sure that these ballots are delivered on time," when he sort of walked back the USPS's initial and official position on this. The Daily Beast reported that last week or the week before, there was a meeting of a new elections USPS working group. And he again said, "Oh, there's issues with how these ballots are being produced." So he's laying the blame in advance, I guess, is the problem for why there might be an issue with ballot delivery. And even a small number of problematic ballot returns could have an enormous impact on this election in key swing states.
But Jeremy Sol writes for Slate.com, and your piece about DeJoy is just phenomenal. One of the things that I also found interesting was, so he said, "Okay, I will stop making those changes." He assured Congress, "I'll stop doing this." Well, the problem is he pulled the plug on a bunch of assorting machines. You know, if you're going to stop, does that mean you get to put the plug back in? or do you still have to keep the plug out of the sorting machines? And from your piece, my understanding is that you're not, you know, stopping doesn't mean going back. And as a result, all these sorting machines that have been unplugged, they have been ordered not to put the plug back in. Is that correct?
Some of those sorting machines were actually disassembled and junked and are just, you know, worthless because they're garbage. But then others, yes, they're just sitting there. The outlet has been taken out. And he was asked during his congressional testimony, even if it's just to reassure people, would you just ask that your post office warehouses just please plug those back in, even if it's just for our own delusions that this helps something? And he flat out refused to do that. Not only did he flat out refuse to do that, prior to that, his post office issued an order to those middle managers at those warehouses saying, do not do anything without guidance from us. Do not plug those back in. Do not reinstall any sorting machines. Do not do anything of the sort, no matter what your needs are, no matter anything like that, just don't do it. So he's stopping them from doing it, and he's flatly saying he will not reverse it in this one specific instance.
Now, I'm not sure I read this in your article. I've been reading so much about the USPS. My understanding is that at some point, it is not uncommon for election officials to ask to go into the postal warehouse or the sorting location just to sort of get a lay of the land and to sort of look. I know, for example, in Colorado and in Oregon, they actually have a relationship with the post office, and it's not uncommon for them to do something called a sweep, where they go in and they check to make sure that things aren't put in the wrong places and they're looking for bundled ballots and whatever. My understanding is that our Postmaster General does not want to allow people to go into the physical plant of the postal warehouses or whatever to do what historically has been done in places like Colorado, like Oregon, because that's how they've been operating. They've been doing vote by mail forever, but they understand the challenges of the post office and they have a relationship with the post office. But that was before Postmaster General DeJoy. And that's what terrifies me as well, is that even the states that are well-oiled machines, he may be trying to actually make it difficult for them to do what they've done for, you know, almost a decade, if not more.
So that wouldn't surprise me at all. I hadn't heard that, but that wouldn't surprise me at all based on the complete lack of transparency and actually the obstruction in terms of preventing any sort of transparency. What's important is, at the very least, the House Oversight Committee has, as of the other week, sent him a number of subpoenas to clarify why he made these moves, the data he used to make these moves, the data that shows how service rates were affected, the data that shows how service rates are currently going, all of which he's just refused to turn over to Congress despite his obligations and despite their requests. And they have a subpoena out that is deadline September 16th. So there is some hopefulness that maybe he will comply with such a subpoena and maybe he will issue that bare minimum of transparency. At the same time, the way this administration has responded to any sort of oversight attempts, to any sort of subpoena attempts, is to obstruct them entirely. So we really don't know what's going to happen, and I guess we'll find out in 1 week from today. Or one week from Wednesday, sorry.
I'm going to recommend that everyone run right now to Slate.com or go to my Facebook page, because I'm posting this article from Slate.com. Phenomenal, phenomenal comprehensive piece by Jeremy Stahl. It's entitled, This Is Still Happening, Louis DeJoy, Postmaster General. Unbelievable piece, incredibly well done. And I truly do hope that they use your piece as the template for a documentary, because this is literally, of all the stories I've read, he is such a perfect movie. He is such a perfect movie. And the level of corruption is just overwhelming. Thank you so much for writing for Slate.com. And thank you so much for joining me, Jeremy. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Arnie. It's always fun.
All right. So, all right, everyone. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Stephanie Collender, my producer, and Dave Scott. We will schmooze tomorrow. Ciao, stay safe.
You bet. Change.